Hello and welcome to the Weekly Defence Podcast, the show about defence procurement and military technology. We are brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, NAMO. I'm your host, Richard Thomas, and on the show this week, news editor Ben Vogel talks to Leonid Nasisyan, an Armenian defence journalist, on the effect of the coronavirus pandemic on the Russian armed forces. And I grab a chat with our special correspondent, Tim Fish, on the latest developments on the Australian submarine programme. But first, some news from this week. And in the UK, several vendors have confirmed that they will participate in the programme to replace the Royal Navy's Harpoon Block 1C anti-ship missile system. Kongsberg, Saab and MBDA have all said they'll be involved. An invitation to tender is due later this year before final selection in 2021. The German army is to deploy a new wheeled self-propelled artillery system that will use the in-service Boxer 8x8 MRAV multirole vehicle, but with the rear mission module replaced by the KMW artillery gun module. Meanwhile, the Polish Armament Inspectorate is preparing to buy new lightweight disposable anti-tank missile systems for the country's armed forces, with a tender expected to be launched later this year. And in the Middle East, the Israeli Navy has terminated a program to use unarmed and armed USVs for maritime patrol missions. This is somewhat surprising, as while unmanned underwater systems remain under evaluation, there is now no alternative plan for Israel to deploy unmanned surface assets. And finally, the head of the US Coast Guard, Admiral Carl Schultz, said this week that the offshore patrol cutter program was back on track as Eastern Shipbuilding worked towards the new delivery timeline of the first-in-class US CGC Argus in 2022. To discuss these and more, I'm joined by news editor Ben Vogel and land reporter Flavia Camargo-Sprera. Hi, both.
Hello.
Hello, Ben. Hello, Richard.
Just briefly, if I can ask everyone how their Easter was. Did it all go to plan?
Yes, it went fairly well. I was able to sleep in, thank God, and get a little bit of much-needed rest. So I'm ready for the week.
Not too bad. That's exactly what a four-day weekend is for. Perfect. Flavia, how did you spend your time off?
I spent my time eating chocolate, basically.
Oh, me too. Okay, Ben, so over to you. I think the news has emerged that the French army is using MBDA MMP anti-tank guided missile systems in West Africa. So can we dig a little bit deeper into that?
Yes, indeed. Andrew White filed this particular story. Now, the MMP supports various conventional fire missions as part of a counterinsurgency operations in Mali in West Africa. So it's being used by the French army and special forces, firing from tripods to target buildings, compounds, and various soft-skinned vehicles that could be carrying IEDs. The MMP is supported in Mali by the Novadem vertical takeoff and landing UAV for reconnaissance as well as target acquisition. This enables French forces in Mali to engage enemies not just from beyond line of sight, but also from behind and through cover. So in essence, Novadem creates a kind of local ISTAR chain that can integrate with other battlefield sensors.
I mean, for me, does this indicate that France needs an extra capability for the conflict in Mali, or is it more of further development and testing of the platform, of the system, I should say?
It's probably a bit of both. I mean, there are a number of technical experiments that are underway with MMP to integrate the missile aboard remotely operated unmanned ground vehicles, specifically the Milrem Robotics Themis. Obviously, this isn't going on in Mali, but it's a possible development path for the system. On the Themis, a light turret is fitted with two MMP missiles and a machine gun for self-defense. MMP is kind of envisaged really as a kind of replacement for the Milan anti-tank missiles. And as you know, that variants of Milan go back to the 1970s, so perhaps a replacement is long overdue. It's going to be integrating the MMP on board EBRC Jaguar armoured reconnaissance and combat vehicles. And I think the date for that is 2023.
Okay, interesting. Thanks, Ben. Flavia, over to you. We've got something on small arms with the Czech Republic. Is that about right?
Yeah, the Czech MOD has announced its intention to procure more than 39,000 small guns. It includes assault rifles and pistols, and these guns it will keep its armed forces. The total estimated investment, it will be $94 million, and the supplier will be the national company CZUB. These guns, they are manufactured following the NATO patterns, and they'll be able to equip Czech units deployed on overseas missions and also units inside the country in working national operations.
As I understand it, the tender to procure these firearms has been delayed. So any sort of reasons as to why this has actually happened?
Yeah, this is a multi-year contract with CZUB. This contract will run until 2025, and it's likely to be signed by this month. But the framework contract should have been signed almost 1 year ago. This process, it was delayed after a failed bidder complaint to the Office for the Protection of Competition of the Czech Republic. And it caused this delay in the process. But now the Czech MOD is ordering about 5,000 more small guns than stated in the original tender. And the price increased, but according to the MOD, the value of the individual weapons remained the same.
Okay. Interesting. Thanks, Flavia. Just a few more details on the USCG OPC program, as there have been a few updates over the past few weeks. So Eastern Shipbuilding announced on the 9th of April that the US Coast Guard had executed a contract modification for the shipyard to begin build of the second in class and procure long lead items for the third OPC. That follows the completion of a readiness review in February. The manufacturer Eastern Shipbuilding has stated that the contract with the US Coast Guard includes the production of up to four vessels. So that's four planned of up to a lot. I think the hope and the intention was maybe 20 to 25, but we'll see how many the Coast Guard can actually afford because it's a little bit strapped for cash at the moment. So anyway, on the 20th of March, the Coast Guard announced the award of eight OPC industry study contracts to try and mitigate risk and ensure completion of the program. So these contracts, I mean, in terms of monetary value, they were valued at maybe 1.2 million up to 3 million, awarded to a long list, actually. I've got the long list, if you just bear with me. We've got Austal USA, Bath Ironworks, Bollinger Shipyards, Eastern Shipbuilding Group, of course, Fincantieri Marinette Marine, Huntington Ingalls, Philly Shipyard, and VT Halter Marine. Anyway, so all these contracts and these shipyards will assess the OPC design and the technical data and the program's construction approach. Based on this, the companies will then recommend to the Coast Guard whether and if changes could be made to the further construction of future vessels to provide either a better timeline or increased capability for the vessels as they come on board. But it's an interesting program because it's one of three that the Coast Guard on the surface is really trying to push forward and get completed. It's got the OPC, of course, has the National Security Cutter and the Fast Response Cutter. Now these three classes are replacing very old, aging vessels in the Coast Guard fleet. And this recapitalization effort that the US Coast Guard has been engaged on is... It goes a long way to rectifying sustainment issues and gaps in capability that it might have had. But whether it manages to get the vessels in service fast enough or it has enough money at hand to buy all the ships it wants, those remain questions. The Admiral Schultz was hopeful that Congress and the administration in Washington recognize the difficulties that the Coast Guard has in terms of finances. So we'll just have to wait and see if all his dreams are realized over the next couple of years. But anyway, the development on the OPC program, as you said, it's back on track. And is a welcome development for sure.
Richard, can I ask you, the FRC program is on track, as you say, and you mentioned the issues around sustainment. As you know, the GAO recently took aim at the US Navy for sustainment issues on a number of surface vessel programs and across the Navy, across the service. So to what extent do you think those problems might resurface in terms of the Coast Guard?
I don't think the Coast Guard has structural issues with its sustainment. Its problem was it's keeping going old ships. And as ships get older, they need a lot more TLC to make them ready for the next operational cycle. So I think that's the main difficulty for the Coast Guard, that the recapitalization efforts that we've just touched on, they're absolutely welcome. But, you know, some of the vessels that the Coast Guard is operating currently, they're 40, 50, in some cases, let's even say 60 years old. So obviously keeping those ships at sea is difficult, and they'll be delighted that the National Security Cutter, particularly those frigate-sized platforms, they look to be doing a sterling job, to be honest. And the hopes will be, for sure, that the OPC and the OPC program can deliver to the same kind of standard as the National Security Cutter. As you mentioned, the Fast Response Cutter. So these are the near-shore littoral response cutters to do a lot of maritime security work, a lot of drug interdiction and things like that. I think they've delivered, I want to say, 37 out of a 58 whole program. So yeah, it's let's say there's light at the end of the tunnel for the Coast Guard, and not without some difficulties in actually getting the process done.
Okay,
thanks both. Coming up next, it's Tim Fish and the latest on the Australian submarine program.
Hey, have you been using the Defence Insight tool that we signed up to the other month?
Have I? It's so useful, being able to call up all those equipment entries and compare specs. I'm not sure how we got by without it.
I know, right? But they've also just launched the Defence Insight Program Index, which is now live on the dashboard.
Oh, I've been looking forward to that. This covers both the current and forecast requirements across all major platforms, right?
It sure does. The dashboard now gives us access to really detailed program information, including requirement data, total spending, contract award years, and first delivery year.
This is great. It links suppliers, bidders, and the system being offered with direct links to the equipment entry pages.
Yeah, and you can export all program and forecasting data. It's going to be so useful for that super urgent project the boss has me working on, looking at wheeled armored vehicle programs over the next 10 years.
For Defence Insight subscribers, the much-anticipated Program Index is now live on your dashboard. Covering current and forecast requirements across all major systems, the Program Index accounts for 80% of global defence spending. Access this latest upgrade today through Defence Insight by Shepherd Media.
George Washington, Sun Tzu, and Machiavelli have each at one point or another said words to the effect of the best form of defence is attack. Well, it seems the Australian MOD also follows the same axiom with its attack-class submarine programme, one of the most ambitious and potentially troubled procurement efforts in the Asia-Pacific region. To dive into Australia's submarine intentions, I'm joined by Tim Fish, special correspondent at Shepherd. Tim, hi.
Good evening.
Tim, where is the attack-class programme at now then?
Well, it's still very early stages. The Australians want to get 12 new boats to be built in Australia under a contract worth looking at, with inflation, about 80 billion Australian dollars. And these are going to bring 5,000-ton submarines, about 95 metres long, and production isn't due to start until 2023-24. And these will be built by French Shipbuilder Naval Group, which was selected back in 2016. So it's 4 years on, but the programme has already come across quite a few different hiccups, which suggests that there's a lot of risk involved and there's a lot of management and a lot of hard work to be done by both Naval Group and Australian Defence.
I mean, we're talking about more than a decade yet before the first boat is delivered, let alone commissioned.
Why is it taking so long? And does it sort of tally with the removal of the Collins class from service?
Yeah, they've got a long lead-in time because they've decided to choose a new submarine design. So that, and also to build in a new shipyard, ASC Osborne North. So building a new shipyard to a new submarine design, which is kind of based on a French nuclear submarine design. So they need that longer period to kind of get all those steps in place, the manufacturing and all the contracts ready. And then obviously, as you say, Collins, that'll start, those submarines, existing submarines will start to leave service from the mid-2030s. But unfortunately, the program seems to have run over a few bumps already, even at this early stage where they're trying to figure out get the design actually down on paper properly. There's an Australian National Audit Office report that was published back in January called Future Submarine Programme Transition to Design, which highlighted a lot of delays and structural problems with the programme that's been experienced over the last couple of years. And it's come to the conclusion that there's already a 9-month delay on a couple of key elements of the programme so far. Detailed is one called the concept studies review and one called the systems requirements review. Both of these are important parts of this development phase going forwards. So looking at this early stage, even getting the design confirmed and getting to the next stage of each phase as it progresses is becoming difficult.
So what have, well, I guess my question is, was the right structure in place from the start of the program, or are they having to adapt it on the fly? And if the structure wasn't in place, why wasn't it?
Yeah, the National Audit Office has identified sort of a lack of communication about what is required at each stage of these phases that they're going through at the moment. And the commercial and engineering approaches seem to be quite different between what Australian Defence expects and what Naval Group thinks they have to deliver. So going through some of these phases, you have with this concept studies review. This is a key part of what this initial contract was called the design and mobilisation contract. Now that's been in place since Naval Group was selected back in 2016, and Defence has complained that not enough information was provided by Naval Group to begin this concept studies review, and therefore they couldn't move on to the next phase of the program. So they were still working on this design and mobilization contract, but couldn't finish it because they hadn't had the information. They desperately wanted to move on to the next phase, which is a new contract, which is a submarine design contract, to actually get forward putting in place the actual final design. So there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, and they extended this design and mobilization contract, the initial element of it, to cover this extra work that needs to be done and to make sure that Naval Group could provide all the information that was necessary. They extended that through, and the submarine design contract was finally signed in March 2019. But as a part of that, there's a kind of a reset at this point where Naval Group requested a 15-month delay to the overall project, but Australian Defence weren't happy with that, and they gave them 9 months. So the programme now has a 9-month delay from the original plan, but under the submarine design contract, this is all reset, and that 9-month delay is now set in as a part of that program. So there's a new schedule in place now, and a key part of this new contract was this the next element, which is the system requirements review. But the National Audit Office found that Naval Group wasn't ready to begin this part of the contract either. And that was due to start in September 2019, and eventually they got rolling on that in December, which is now a 5-week delay. So there's a lot of these steps going through, and Naval Group's having to play catch up a little bit. But the question is whether or not you have Defence is being clear about what their requirements are, or is Naval Group able to understand what the requirements are from Defence so that they can meet those. The relationship between these two is key for a programme this size, you know, $80 billion to succeed. Therefore, they had this strategic partnership agreement, which was signed earlier in 2019, to manage that relationship between the two partners. I mean, this is going to last for 50 years because the submarine's going to be built through to 2050. It's very important that these two partners get on. But the risk there is quite significant if they're still trying to sort out how it all works at this stage.
What about local content? I mean, obviously, it's a French design. Where is Australian industry going to get a piece of the pie?
That's another issue that's kind of been, it's kind of one of the elements of risk here, because as a part of the part of this new design and the part of the contract is that Australian industry has to provide a significant portion of the work. The issue with this is that the local industry in Australia doesn't necessarily have the capabilities to support the program. So at Pacific 2019, there are a lot of announcements about local companies in Australia providing steel, a lot of kind of the metal bashing kind of work. But even that needed building up, because some of the steel manufacturing wasn't to the standard that's been required for submarines. So they had to invest money into companies to improve their steelmaking capability to get it to the right grade that's required for submarines. So a lot of investments even going in at this point now. But if that needs to happen across a whole load of other areas, time's starting to run out, even though they've made allowances for, you know, a long lead time before production starts. If you have to start upgrading all these different elements of Australian industry, you've got to overrun, because work packages for the equipment to build the first submarines, they take 2 years to put in place, from right from an expression of interest through a competition and an actual contract award. So if that takes 2 years just by itself, and you've got it, and then you've even got to upgrade the industry, Australia may not be able to provide the level of local content that's required. So therefore, more work may have to go back to France. So it raises questions about what kind of a level of sovereign control Australia will have over these submarines. So there's a whole load of wider issues associated with that as well, and it's one of the main sort of areas of risk going forwards.
What about the design then? Obviously, as you mentioned, it's an adapted Suffren, which is a nuclear-powered boat, which will be in service with the French Navy. So it's a very big SSK. I think it displaces around 50% greater displacement at the surface than Japan's new Soyuz class. So why has Australia gone for such a large SSK? There are smaller options elsewhere.
Yeah, they've always gone for a very large SSK because they don't want to have a nuclear-powered submarine. So, the problem is with Australia is they've got such a long way to go to get to the area of operations, which is, you know, Southeast Asia, the Indian Ocean, the Northern Pacific areas. So to get that distance, they need a larger submarine with longer legs on it, basically, so they can get places. But without nuclear power, they're going to have to just have a very large submarine. The problem with what they've chosen is because it's the French Barracuda 1A design that's being used to build the French Navy's new Suffren class submarines. They have to convert it from a nuclear powered boat into a conventionally powered boat with engine and lead acid batteries. So it's almost a totally new design in a lot of ways, because there's a lot of redesign and conversion going on. So that's kind of where they are at the moment with why they've chosen that kind of design. There were other options, but I think Australia's decided it really wants to be quite ambitious with its choices going forward.
Is there a plan B in case it all goes wrong?
There have been reports about sort of a second option, where there's an exit clause that Australian Defence can get out of this contract and maybe go to another manufacturer to get some sort of off-the-shelf submarines potentially. But as far as I'm aware, there are no discussions with any other manufacturers about procuring new platforms. I mean, Australian, with these kind of, as is in case of a lot of these very large contracts, Australian politicians and the Department of Defence and the companies, they're all way too invested at this, even at this early point. And it's very unlikely that they want to back out at this stage. There's still a long way to go. There are a lot of problems, but if these can be ironed out, then and if it can be made to work, then they'll end up with a very good submarine. So, I mean, this is going ahead, even if there are concerns and high levels of risk moving forward.
Most procurement programs, you see a fewer number of platforms coming into service to replace more numerous but less capable older versions. This is the other way around. I mean, Australia's really gone in big to improve the Navy with the Hunter class and the Attack class. It's spending a lot of money Is it the right sort of acquisition, do you think, for the Australian Navy?
Well, Australia's looked at the sort of done its futures analysis and seen the rise of China and the amount of submarines that are going to be bought by countries in the Asia Pacific region. And it's not pretty because there's going to be a lot of submarines out there. And Australia has looked at its six Collins class and decides it needs double the amount of submarines. So 12 platforms is quite a lot. So looking ahead, they need these platforms. Obviously, you know, they need them sooner rather than later, really. I mean, the first boat isn't going to enter service until 2032 time frame, so you're looking at a long way down the track, so that the strategic situation may have changed within the next decade or so, but then Australia will be on the cusp of introducing these new boats into service, but then technologies will have moved on as well, so it remains to be seen if they've made the right choices.
Final one from me, Tim. I'm going to put you on the spot. Do you think Australia Naval Group can get this over the line and, you know, relatively on time and on schedule?
Looking at the kind of work that needs to be done, I think they will get the submarines. I think they'll push through. But whether it will be on schedule, I think it's unlikely. There's a lot of work that needs to be done to get the industrial partnerships in place with Australian industry, to get the training of the crews, even the transition from going from the attack submarines, from the Collins class submarines to the attack submarines, is going to take a lot of work. They have to expand the amount of crews they have. They said it the same with the Hunter class frigates. This is a national endeavour. This is something that's going to require a huge amount of effort and expense across the whole of Australian government. This is not just, you know, an MOD plan. This is, you know, looking at industry, recruiting people across the board to get the kind of skills necessary to develop a domestic Australian-only sort of submarine manufacturing capability that they're going to sustain going forwards. These are, you know, some of the most ambitious defence acquisition projects going out there at the moment across any country, really. So that comes with a big amount of risk involved, but they're dedicated towards it, and so they will get it. They will make it happen, even if it's a little bit late and maybe a few billions over budget.
Yeah, indeed. Tim Fish, special correspondent at Shepherd. Many thanks for taking time in joining us. Take care.
Did you know that Shepherd Media is fully digital?
Yeah, of course. I've already downloaded the app. I love that I can access high-quality stories anywhere, anytime. That's good for when you're deployed, right?
I actually like that the stories don't waste my time. It's like the editors know what and when I want to read.
And that you don't have to read them. You can watch a video or check out the infographics.
Yeah, it's ace. Did you see that piece on Iran? That piece on the Tor M1 air defense system where they outlined...
Download the free Shepherd News app on the App Store and Google Play, and you can get 3 months half price on Shepherd Premium News for a limited time.
I'm with our Yerevan-based freelancer, Leonid Nersisian, to talk about the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on Russian armed forces policy and plans for the Victory Day parade, which may or may not go ahead next month. Leonid, COVID-19 is a global problem, so Russia isn't immune to its effects, although it does report fewer cases per capita than many other countries. What have been the main consequences so far for the Russian armed forces?
Ben, there are lots of difficult problems in Russian armed forces, but the policy is not saying about them too much. And I think the first biggest problem is conscripting, conscript, because Russia needs to conscript at least 135,000 new troops. And these processes are not going on because nobody knows what to do. It's really difficult to do a conscript in Moscow or in big cities where everything is quarantined, closed, and not working. And the same thing we can say about army itself, which is conscripted army, and most of personnel is living in barracks and very close to each other. And as you can understand, even if one serviceman will be infected, I think almost all other servicemen will be infected too. And whole base can be paralyzed by the COVID, like the same situation with the American aircraft carrier. One is getting infected and everyone else is getting infected.
Indeed. Now, this spring conscription program is still officially in progress, is it not? Or are there any indications that the Russian MOD might cancel it?
On March 30, Putin signed the document and conscript officially started, and it should last from April 1 to July 15. But in reality, nothing is going on. And MOD said that they are not going to conscript anybody before May 20. But if we look at the situation, we will understand that in May 20, everything may be even worse than now. So, because in Russia, the epidemic is only starting now. I think Russian government is thinking very hard what to do, despite some pressure from MOD, which need to get new troops. But I think the only option which can be considered is making conscription only in small cities and some regions where COVID-19 is not very common.
So, Leonid, will this have some kind of knock-on effect on Russian defense capabilities?
I think they are affected the same way like other armies are affected. Nobody is doing very well now. I can say that they are pretty strict isolation in Russian army. Like, nobody can visit bases. Officers are not leaving bases, and whole army is affected. And you can remember the story with Russian nuclear-powered submarine, which was out of service for at least 2 weeks because somebody from the crew contacted with infected civilians. So I think everything is going on like in other countries, the same problems. With Navy is very difficult to isolate or to keep it safe because ships are small, everybody is living very close, so...
Indeed, and you mentioned the case of the USS Theodore Roosevelt, and indeed also the French aircraft carrier Charles de Gaulle has also announced an outbreak of COVID. So in many ways, the Russian armed forces are suffering in a similar way to other militaries around the world. But at the same time, we've noticed and reported at Shepherd that the Russian military continues to hold military exercises and continues to test advanced weapon systems when NATO member states and other militaries around the world are pivoting to deal with their domestic COVID problems. It doesn't seem as though Russia's quite at that stage yet. Is that fair?
That's some kind of Russian style of work. I don't know. They will do it until they won't meet some very difficult consequences of what they are doing. So it's difficult for me to say why are they doing these military exercises now. I think they are not very serious about this virus, or maybe in MOD they are not very serious with this virus. So, but I think if everything is going to go this way and epidemic will become stronger and stronger, even in Russia, they will stop doing these military drills.
And in fact, I believe there was a report in the Kommersant daily newspaper just the day before yesterday, in fact, in which it announced or published a leaked document indicating the first confirmed cases of COVID in the Russian armed forces. So perhaps this big problem is looming ever larger.
Yes, I think so. But if you look at official data, still there is no answer to this commerce and publication and MOD spending that they don't have any cases of COVID in Russian army. So I don't really believe in this information. And if you look at commerce and publications, this information is dated by March 30. So
right.
At April 16, we may have much more cases in Russian army. So it's really difficult to say how many and where, but I think we will have some media leaks later on this topic.
And in fact, in the Russian population as a whole, today, the 16th of April, marked the fifth consecutive daily record increase in reported coronavirus cases. I think it's fair to suggest that the problem will grow in scale. One of the big annual events, as we all know, Leonid, in Russia, military events every year, is the Victory Day Parade. It's still just about scheduled for the 9th of May, and it has a special significance this year to mark the 75th anniversary of the end of the Second World War, or the Great Patriotic War, as it's known in Russia. However, we understand that the cancellation or postponement could be on the cards.
Yes, that's true. I don't think that they will cancel it because, as you said, it's very important for Russia. But there were some number of options considered in Russian leadership. And one of them was doing the parade without any spectators. But now I think the option number one is postponing the parade, and maybe they will do it on September 3 at the day of the end of World War II. As you know, in Russia, they changed the date from September 2 to September 3 because they ended the war with Japanese one day later than US did. So,
I see. You mentioned or referred to the sort of lack of information from the MOD on the impact of COVID. It's very much par for the course for the Russian government to, let's say, be economical with the truth when it comes to adverse situations. What evidence is there of cooperation between the Russian MOD and other militaries around the world? Probably not in NATO, to be fair. To coordinate a kind of a military response to this problem.
You know the Russian help to Italy? I think everybody knows this story already. They sent some chemical troops from Russia, and I think about 100 servicemen and some disinfection cars and some laboratories. If we are talking about other countries, we should remember Syria. But if we speak about Syria, there is a big lack of information about this country and what is going on there. I can say that Russian troops there are performing disinfection of their bases all the time, and they are pretty isolated too. And if somebody is coming back from Syria to Russia, they do the two-week quarantine in Moscow before moving to their base in some other region. I think Syria is the most difficult case because nobody really knows if there is an epidemic there or no. And nobody knows real numbers. So I think it's very risky for Russian troops to be there, but we can also see that there are no active warfare going on there anymore because all the sides understood that it's a bad idea now.
Indeed. Thank you very much, Leonid Nasisian.
Thank you, Ben, for a very interesting interview.
This episode of the Weekly Defense Podcast was brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, Namo. As always, a big thanks to everyone that took the time in being a part of the episode. And for our listeners, make sure you like and subscribe, leave a review on iTunes, and tell a friend or a colleague about the podcast. Until next week, thanks for listening.